Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Lawmakers in Lansing are quickly wrapping up the state budget for the next fiscal year. On today's program, what the $50 billion spending plan will mean for you. And then we look at the efforts to help prison inmates rebuild their lives through post-secondary education. But first, the Council of Great Lakes Governors met this past weekend on Mackinac Island. The group talked of economic cooperation and harmonizing plans for protecting the largest body of fresh water on the Earth's surface. The discussions were mostly nice, but there were some disagreements, especially when it came to dealing with invasive species. Michigan Public Radio's Rick Pluta explains.
The governor's view was of the rainy and overcast Straits of Mackinac as they took horse-drawn carriages to the island's historic Grand Hotel. The governors of Michigan, Illinois, Wisconsin, and Indiana showed up, as well as the premier of the Canadian province of Ontario, and about 150 others representing all eight Great Lakes states, Ontario and Quebec. The governors were greeted by U.S. Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood, also a former congressman from Illinois.
There is no other place in America that has what's in this region, the Great Lakes. There isn't. You can't think of another place.
The group was told the Great Lakes area is an economic powerhouse. At 100 million people and $5.5 trillion in annual economic activity, its gross domestic product would make it the world's fourth largest regional economy. The governors agreed there's more bringing them together than setting them apart. Not politics, not even the fierce football rivalry between the Chicago Bears and the Green Bay Packers, said Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker.
When it comes to the Great Lakes and water issues, there really is no party affiliation. There is no issue, by and large, between even those of us in the United States and Canada. It's a shared interest.
But that shared interest can also be a friction point. Talk of economic cooperation turned to environmental questions and continued disagreement on ballast standards, water diversion, and what to do about invasive species, especially the Asian carp. The fish has thoroughly infested the Mississippi River system, and there are fears it will enter the Great Lakes via a shipping canal in Chicago that flows into Lake Michigan. Illinois Governor Pat Quinn, a Democrat, raised some eyebrows when he reversed an earlier position and said it makes sense to physically separate the Mississippi River system and Lake Michigan, just like they were 100 years ago.
Ultimately, I think we have to separate the basins. That's a major, huge public works project for America. I really feel that that is the ultimate solution.
But that's an expensive proposition. Estimates on a project to close and replace the canal range from $4 billion to $9 billion, depending on how it's done. And Indiana Governor Mike Pence, a Republican, says it would disrupt almost $2 billion in economic activity on the canals and rivers in his state that feed into the Chicago waterway.
I believe separating the Great Lakes would cost thousands of Hoosier jobs and cause additional harm to many Hoosiers who manufacture and grow our products.
Pence says he believes it's possible to manage the growth and migration of Asian carp without closing the canal. Chris Kolb of the Michigan Environmental Council supports physically separating the two water systems, and he says Quinn's new position is a breakthrough.
Once you get them saying that's the solution, you then can press forward. I mean, yes, it's not going to happen tomorrow. We wish it would. But the sooner we do it, the sooner we solve the problem. And the threat is huge. And so I think that you get a couple, you get critical mass, it happens.
There's still a lot that would have to happen to separate the two water systems. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers is still studying the issue. There's also the question of how to pay for it. The governors say it would be tough for their states to pick up that multi-billion dollar burden. But it also wasn't that long ago that Michigan and some other states were in court trying to force Illinois to close the canal. Now the state's governor says it would be a good idea. For the Michigan Public Radio Network, I'm Rick Pluta on Mackinac Island.
So let's get the scientist's view now on just where things stand with the Asian carp in the Great Lakes. Joining us from Columbia, Missouri is Dwayne Chapman. He is a research fish biologist with the U.S. Geological Survey. Now, we just heard our Capitol reporter Rick Pluta's story about the possible closure of that Chicago canal. So we wanted to focus our attention on the actual fish in question. How close is the actual Asian carp to the Great Lakes?
There have been three fish caught in the Great Lakes themselves that we know of, three bighead carp in Lake Erie, but none of them since about 2000. So over the last 13 years, we haven't caught any. It doesn't mean they're not there, but we haven't caught any. There has been one fish caught very close to the Great Lakes in the Chicagoland area, in the Chicago area waterway system. Besides those fish, in terms of any substantial populations of Asian carps, you really have to go about 30 or 40 miles from the southern end of Lake Michigan to get into a few fish. So, and they have to get through a barrier.
That electric barrier that was installed.
That's right.
Now, so they did discover some Asian carp DNA beyond that electric barrier, didn't they?
They did, and they found Asian carp DNA above that barrier in the Chicagoland area, and also they found Asian carp DNA in the southern part of Lake Erie, in southwestern Lake Erie. They found both bighead and silver carp DNA. And it would be unlikely if we captured them all. I mean, it's just, you know, and these DNA techniques are very, very sensitive. There's no evidence that there's been any recruitment, that is, any spawning or survival of the young in those few bighead carp that are present in Lake Erie. There's no evidence of any of that. So that hasn't changed at all in the last 13 years.
So we would say that is good news, however.
However, we've got this, but what's really new is the silver carp DNA. So we found the bighead carp DNA, but the silver carp, no one's ever caught a silver carp in Lake Erie, and it's really odd that we're getting silver carp DNA there. So it kind of has everybody scratching their heads. Is this a real thing is this indicative of a real fish? Or is it some other way that the DNA from these fish is getting up to Lake Erie? And that's a really tough question to answer. Some people think that if you're getting any of this DNA that far from known populations, that it's got to be a live fish. Mm-hmm. And other people think, well, we do know that the stuff can be moved around by birds and their feces. And so it's kind of hard to really answer that question at this point. We don't know for sure whether this DNA is coming from silver carp or not. And there are scientists that disagree as to whether this silver carp DNA that's being caught in Lake Erie actually is coming from a live fish or if it's getting there through some other method. Most of the samples that you get from Lake Erie, by the way, are not positive for silver carp DNA, but that's, you know, a little bit like saying that most of the times you go fishing, you don't catch one.
It does feel, Duane, like every couple of months we'll get a new report about Asian carp, and then it seems that the issue sort of fades into the background. Does it feel to you, from where you sit with the U.S. Geological Survey, you're a research fish biologist watching this from as a scientist, does it feel like we are not fighting the invasion of the species with enough energy and sense of timeliness?
From my standpoint, I mean, I've been here all weekend, and I've probably put in 40 hours over the weekend here at the lab, so we're here fighting it with everything we can. So,
from the policy level, though, and the political level?
That's something that I can't really comment on. It's just not within my purview. I mean,
sure.
I look at this from a biological standpoint, and, you know, when it comes down to whether or not we're fighting it hard enough, you know, that's really a societal question of how do you divert resources from other things. And I'm not in a position to comment about how, you know, what's more important in the Great Lakes. You know,
sure.
I can tell you about Asian carp.
Yep.
I can't tell you about how that relates to some other totally different aspect that, you know, the congressman has to deal with.
Very, very true. Duane Chapman, research fish biologist with the U.S. Geological Survey, with an update on the status of the movement of Asian carp toward the Great Lakes. Thanks for sharing that with us today and talking with us, Duane.
Thank you.
One of the biggest challenges we face as a state, and really as a nation, is how do we keep parole prisoners from becoming repeat offenders and winding up back behind bars? Solid evidence points to post-secondary education as one of the major keys to helping former inmates build productive lives after parole. After many years without any funding for prisoners to be able to access higher education, the Michigan Department of Corrections has gotten a $1 million grant to launch post-secondary educational programs and vocational training to a small number of inmates who are near parole. The program model is based on the Pathways from Prison Post-Secondary Education program. It was created by the Vera Institute of Justice, That's a nonprofit center for justice policy and practice that's based in New York. Joining us from New York is the director of the program, Fred Patrick. And also joining us is a former inmate at the Ionia Correctional Facility. His name is Rick, and we're withholding his last name. Rick was sent to prison in 1984. He was 23, and he served a 9.5-year sentence on a felony charge. It was thanks to classes that he was able to take while in prison, classes offered through Macomb Community College, that Rick found work and built a life for himself after his release. Welcome to both of you. Fred, will you start by tracking for us the history of educational efforts in prison?
Sure. Well, I'm not quite the historian, but as you alluded to, there was, for many years, Pell Grants were a major part of the funding stream for in-prison education programs. And then with the passage of federal legislation in the early 90s, that sort of led to major pullback, again, being that it was a major source of funding. And what we have now are lots of privately funded efforts, but many of which sort of don't have the full range and breadth that you were able to get when you had the Pell Grants. And so what we're trying to do through the Pathways Project, which I should add was funded, is being funded by five large national foundations, Open Society Foundation, Bill and Melinda Gates, the Ford Foundation, the Sunshine Lady Foundation, and the William K. Kellogg Foundation. They all came together with the view of building a demonstration project that would make build the evidence-based case that post-secondary education, along with the needed wraparound supports in terms of housing assistance, family services, employment, placement, that those things together and collectively could make a huge difference in terms of not only increasing public safety, but allowing individuals to better support families and children, to be taxpaying, contributing members of society. And so we're trying to, over the course of the next 4 or 5 years, build that evidence. A lot of the earlier research, of course, suggested that post-secondary education could reduce recidivism by as much as 73%.
What does the Pathways Project look like? How will it operate, and what kind of courses are being offered to the inmates who are able to take part of this?
Sure. So we're currently operating in 3 states. Those states are Michigan, New Jersey, and North Carolina. And it represents partnerships between local colleges and universities and the local prison system, but also parole offices, employers, and reentry service providers in the community. Eligible inmates who, by the way, have to meet all the same educational standards as one would in the community. So you have to have a high school diploma or GED. You have to test in terms of being eligible for college credit courses. If not, there's the developmental track. And so the courses that are being offered range from the liberal arts associates that's being provided in New Jersey to the Associate of Applied Science degree that's being offered in North Carolina. And Michigan is a mixture with a focus on liberal arts, but also, importantly, occupational certificates are a part of this. So individuals are able to, after a certain amount of credits, 12, 16, 18 credits, for instance, they're able to walk away with certificates in things like computer information sciences, business administrations, viable workplace credentials that allow them to connect with that workforce post-release and get jobs that will afford them the opportunity to support themselves and their families.
So giving them the kind of skills that employers are looking for.
Absolutely. One of the things that we required, we put out a limited RFP back in the fall of 2012, inviting 6 states, Michigan being one of them, to apply, to participate. And we required as a part of this that the employers be a part of the equation, that they be one of the stakeholders at the table. So the states will have what we're calling stakeholder implementation teams with employers at the table, and we want employers not just on the back end in terms of providing jobs, but early on providing internships, mentoring, and also being a part of informing what curricula should be available. Again, we see Pathways not just as the provision of higher education to inmates while incarcerated in post-release, but importantly, that it's a part of addressing the college completion agenda. That's a big part of U.S. domestic policy. We see it as a part of the economic prosperity in terms of addressing workplace needs, and importantly, a part of community renewal, sort of ensuring that communities that are disproportionately impacted by crime and incarceration, that individuals are able to come home, get jobs, be providers for themselves, and thus help bring vibrancy back to many of those communities.
Rick, I want to turn to you. You were at Ionia Correctional Facility. You were serving a 9.5-year sentence. What motivated you to apply for the Pell Grant?
What motivated me was that the career field that I was in prior to being incarcerated, I knew I could never go back into.
And what was that?
I am a former military police officer.
All right. So that door was closed to you?
That door and anything dealing with security, yes.
So you, how did you hear about it, and what did you decide you wanted to study?
The way we heard about it was that at the Ionia Correctional Facility, what they do is they post, a notification up there, and they tell you when classes are going to be offered or when there's going to be an orientation or such, and then you go ahead and you sign up for it. The courses open at that time were an associate's in generals, an associate's in accounting, and an associate's in business. Personally, I never saw myself owning my own business. Me, like most other people, I hate math, so I never saw myself as an accountant. But I find that that we all use math on a daily basis, so technically we're accountants in one way or another. But the associates in general, I used that because it had the more elective credits, and I coupled that with my vocational training that I also received while I was at the Ionia Correctional Facility.
And what was that training?
That training was welding.
All right.
I have over 4,000 hours of training in combination welding.
So, Rick, how did getting that education and getting that associate's degree, how did that change your perspective on the future that you saw once you were out of Ionia?
That changed it in a way that I saw myself as being able to be self-supportive. I didn't have to rely on somebody else. I didn't have to rely on a handout. I most definitely did not want to go on some kind of state assistance where I collected a check every 2 weeks. I wanted to stand on my own 2 feet, work with my own 2 hands and know that I was contributing back to society. Up until the time that I was incarcerated, I had always worked. Nobody plans on me committing a crime, at least, in my case, I never planned on committing a crime. But I knew that once I did become incarcerated, I could never go back to my same field of work.
So how did the training and the degree that you got help you once you were paroled and it was time to reenter society? How did you navigate that reentry?
I went through the job market searching based like anybody else would. You pick up the paper. The internet wasn't something that I was versed in at the time. So I primarily relied on word of mouth, contacts, and newspaper. And I went and I kept applying for jobs. And I probably, for every 100 jobs I applied for, I probably might have gotten 2 interviews.
And do you believe that was because you had to check the box that said you had been incarcerated?
On most of them, I can honestly say yes.
Mm-hmm.
But the associate's degree definitely helped. Some jobs that I applied for, you had to have a degree. They were looking more at your skills than more at at what you had done in life. But it was only based on the education that I had that actually got me through the door.
So that was truly the key. Fred Patrick, as you hear Rick talk about the challenges that face, the idea that you walk in and you see someone tossing your whole packet into the trash, how does someone crack through that and get through that popular misconception that this person could be trouble?
Sure. First of all, I wanted to say thank you, Rick, for sharing your story. I think you brought up several very crucial points that need to be amplified, and that's that most folks sort of are looking to be self-supportive, to take care of families and themselves and their kids. A huge part of the Pathways Initiative is that employer engagement piece. It's bringing all of the support services in place from the start. So you'll have the reentry service providers who can work on family services issues, who can work on housing needs, and importantly, who can work on those employer connections.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to be doing outreach to employers to do public education around what's available in terms of tax incentives for hiring formerly incarcerated. We're going to talk about the fact that in some ways these individuals, because they are looking for that second chance, are an even safer bet, if you will, because some of them know what the consequences are to sort of quote-unquote failing. So part of it is educating employers, also beginning to do a sort of public education campaign around the sense that people deserve a second chance, that you have numerous employers. Sometimes people quietly will employ large numbers of individuals who are formerly incarcerated, and simply they're not looking for PR to do it. But we're looking to get some of those folks on board as spokespersons who can at least talk to other business leaders about it. And ultimately, there is the issue of what's the law and what's right. And surprisingly and happily, a lot of states and jurisdictions are moving towards what's called banning the box, in mm-hmm. which that question of conviction is being removed from the initial application so that individuals can at least get in the door and present themselves, and an individual can see efforts and evidence of rehabilitation. An individual can talk through what they have to offer in terms of meeting the bottom line business needs of that organization.
Fred, I'd love your thoughts, and actually you as well, Rick. I'll start with you, Fred. What would you say to someone who would say, you know, it isn't fair for someone who's committed a crime to get this kind of assistance over someone who has never committed a crime, especially since college education is expensive? What do you say to them, Fred?
I say it's not an either or. You know, sometimes I think it's easy for us to fall into these polar extreme arguments. In some ways, it's a straw man argument. The reality is you have thousands and thousands of people, millions of people incarcerated. We spend billions upon billions of dollars in prison costs. We have evidence that suggests that exposure to high, post-secondary education in prison leads to a huge reduction in recidivism, and that ultimately benefits the public coffers, which means you free up more dollars for roads and hospitals and education. It also allows individuals to come home and be what we want everyone to be, which is a tax-paying, contributing member of society. They are able to take care of themselves and their family and therefore not necessarily have to tap into public assistance. And that's ultimately what we want. Post-secondary education also ultimately leads to individuals being, and the evidence says this, better parents, and therefore they can sort of help improve the educational outcomes of their kids. There's evidence that it increases civic participation. And so all around, there's a societal benefit.
So a huge ripple effect. Rick,
absolutely.
Rick, what would you say to the critics?
I definitely agree with what Fred said. But I would also have to tell the critics that, okay, when I received my Pell Grant, I received that for free. I didn't pay any of that back. And it was a good investment on society's part. When I received my vocational training, that was also for free. I didn't have to invest anything but time, and time I had a lot of. Since I've received that training and have been out, my conviction is now 29 years old. I've been out for 17 years. In that 17 years, I've been a productive member of society. I haven't been in any trouble. I've never been arrested, haven't even picked up a traffic ticket. Part of that, and I say part of it, is because I've been able to be self-sufficient. I haven't had to struggle very much for work, to have a paycheck, to be a productive member of society. You know, I think it would have been different had I not had the education, not had the training. And then been trying to reinvent myself. You know, nobody becomes a millionaire working at McDonald's except McDonald's. You have to have a job that will be able to support your family, just like Fred says. If you don't have that, then you look for alternative ways to start supplementing your income, and which usually leads you back into crime. I've seen a lot of guys when I was inside that I knew got paroled. They went home, and a few months later they were back. And you get to talking with them and stuff, and they said, you know, I got stupid, I screwed up, you know, I should have done things different, you know, but, you know, I needed the money. So,
I would say, Fred Patrick, a story like Rick's is what warms your heart and keeps you going in the work you do.
Absolutely, and I wanted to add one other thing. I think it's important that we understand that Pathways, in terms of this national demonstration project, you know, does not rely on federal funding or Pell Grants.
Right.
It's those five national foundations that I talked about. And as you know, foundations are often sort of in the vanguard, you know, for social policy change. And what we're hoping to demonstrate is that in-prison education, higher education, with those wraparound supports does make the crucial difference. I might also add, because oftentimes people talk about the whole Pell Grant story, and there's a fact that is often lost, and that is when Pell Grant eligibility for inmates ended in 1994, that represented only 0.1% of all the Pell Grants received. At that point, Pell Grants were $5.3 billion, and only $34 million were being spent on incarcerated individuals. So the investment was quite small, and yet the public safety gains are potentially huge, and that's what we're hoping to prove through the 4 or 5 years of this demonstration, in which we'll then have an independent evaluation done by the RAND Corporation. And we want to build that evidence to show the public, to show public policymakers, elected officials, that this is, in-prison education is a cost-efficient and effective use of public dollars.
Fred Patrick with the Vera Institute of Justice, directing and guiding the Pathways from Prison Post-Secondary Education program. And Rick, thank you both so much for talking with us and sharing your insights. And we will continue to follow as this Pathways Project initiative continues as a demonstration project in the state of Michigan. Thank you so much.
Thanks for the opportunity. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Michigan almost has a final budget for the next fiscal year at almost $50 billion. Lawmakers in the Republican-led State House and Senate, as well as Governor Snyder, had wanted the budget to be complete by their self-imposed June 1st deadline. Well, they didn't quite make it, but it's looking like it will get finished this week. Joining us now is Chad Livengood, Lansing reporter for the Detroit News. Hey, Chad.
How are you doing today?
Good, exactly. Good. And Chris Gouts is the Capitol correspondent for Crane's Detroit Business. Welcome back, Chris.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
I want to start with the main takeaway of the budget and your thoughts. Now, we saw a quote from Zach Gorchow, the editor of Gongwer News Services, a Lansing publication, calling this a pretty ho-hum budget. Chad, is that a fair statement?
That's pretty fair, yeah. There's not a lot of big, huge things in this. The governor didn't get everything he wanted. That's more of the story here, is that he didn't get the $1.2 billion more for roads that he wanted, and he didn't get authorization to add more than 400,000 people to Medicaid through a federally funded expansion. So those things are still out there. They're not necessarily totally dead. They're certainly on some sort of life support, though, in Lansing these days. But it really is just sort of overall slight increase in across the board most agencies of a state government.
Chris Gouts, are you feeling ho-hum as well?
I am. That was the real story about this budget. I mean, there aren't a lot of highlights, things that are new or things that are expanded. I mean, there are a few things that we can talk about, but mm-hmm. overall, I would agree that the biggest story about this budget is what is not in it. And Chad hit on the two major points. And when I was up on Mackinac Island this past week talking with lawmakers about that, they made the case that that was done by design, that they felt that if they tried to put all those things together, the people would get too distracted by other pieces of the budget and want to start moving things around to accommodate. So they said, well, we'll get the majority of things out of the way, and then we'll just focus on transportation and Medicaid. Now, you can argue that that's them just looking at the clock, sort of like a school kid right before summer break, watching the clock wind down to try to get out of town. Some of these lawmakers are looking at the clock the same way. They want to get out of here by the second or third week of June, with not having taken a vote on raising taxes to increase transportation spending. So the pressure will be on in these last few weeks to get that done. And it sounds more like Medicaid expansion is going to be the big push from the administration to get done before summer break.
All right. Before we get to the transportation funding and that Medicaid expansion issue, let's start with education. We get such intense interest from listeners any time anything to do with schools and education comes up. So we wanted to lead with what they really want to hear about. Now, we know with education, let's talk K through 12. There was a slight per pupil increase in the K through 12 budget, about 3%. What does that actually look like, Chris?
I guess it depends on who you are, because to Democrats, it doesn't look like a whole heck of a lot. And especially when you compare it to what they say has been cut out of the budget for K-12. The governor in the last few weeks and in some of the administration, they've really hit back on that point. And they're starting to make the case that you have seen an actual increase in K-12 every year that he's been governor. It's the cuts before he took office. That's where you really saw the cuts. But the other piece of this is that you're still seeing a chunk taken out of K-12 and put into the general fund and for other purposes and for higher ed and for community colleges, and that's where the real rub is, and that's continuing. And that, although they do make the case that that trend did start under Governor Granholm.
So, Chad Livengood, what does this 3% slight increase actually mean if you're a school administrator or you're a teacher or if you're a student?
About $60 per student more next year. And now, that's the appropriation directly to the schools. But the machinations here a little bit is that there's a couple hundred dollars more per district being paid of their retirement obligations. So rather than the state giving the districts $250 to $300 per student more, they're just giving them $60 to spend internally and then paying some of their bills rather than sending them money and then having them send it back to Lansing. That's kind of been kind of a contentious debate because by doing that, you're not growing the per pupil funding. And that's what everyone looks at as far as a number to study how much money are we putting in individually into our school districts. But at the end of the day, they are giving the districts some relief in their rising pension and retirement costs. Back to this point about the money that's being taken from the school aid fund to cover the bills for community colleges and higher ed, it's about $400 million between two. For community colleges, they are taking $197 million out of school aid, and the rest of the funding for community colleges is $138 million. So in the past, this has been totally funded out of general fund. But in 2010, Governor Granholm, in kind of a late-year budget gimmick to try to balance the budget, moved a bunch of money out of school aid into the general fund to cover the community colleges and higher ed bills so they didn't have to do a bunch of mid-year cuts. Governor Snyder came into office in 2011, saw that Governor Granholm did this. There's some wording in the Constitution under what school aid money can go to, and the word higher education is in there. He used that, and he's been doing it ever since. Democrats and school groups are pretty well united. They don't like this. Even the community colleges and universities don't like it because they see that their education brethren are upset that they think that this is depleting the school aid or public schools of $400 million a year.
Lots of eyes cast on this. And let's get to higher education. With that budget, you see university and colleges get a 2% increase, but some social issues got thrown into all of this regarding embryonic stem cell research and not allowing the schools to offer health care to domestic partners of employees. Chris, can you tell us more of that?
Well, this is something that's come up in years past. You know, there are some Republican lawmakers who don't like some of the things that the universities are doing in this respect. And so they include these items for them to submit reports. You know, they can't stop them from doing certain things in some of these cases, but they can say, aha, well, I'll make you detail everything that you do about stem cells or everything you do about certain types of healthcare offerings. And in some cases, the universities have said, you know what, that's great, but we're not going to do it. And I believe it was last year where Governor Snyder, I think he vetoed a piece of that regarding stem cell reporting for the University of Michigan.
Yes.
So it's something that they always do. And then it usually, in most cases, there's not any follow-up, but it allows them to go back to their constituencies and say, you know, I tried to stop this or I tried to make them shine more light in these areas.
Well, in this boilerplate language is where if you're a lawmaker and you want to get a pound of flesh out of a institution, this is a way to do it. Last year, some legislators were upset over Michigan State requiring students to have insurance. It smelled like Obamacare to them for some reason. And they caused Michigan State to drop that because they were going to threaten to withhold millions of dollars over requiring kids to carry health insurance, whether they get it from Michigan State or from their parents.
Right.
Just in case they, you know, trip and fall while they were sort of, you know, under the influence of some intoxicants on campus. So these are the kinds of things that happened. Earlier this year, we had this big fight about right to work. They ended up taking this language out, but they were going to penalize U of M and Wayne State and some schools and community colleges over signing big, long contract extensions that bypassed the right to work law and allowed unions to continue collecting mandatory dues before the law went into effect March 28th.
they ended up backing off that and that threat, and they took that out. But they made their point early on, and that's what they like to do sometimes.
So it's kind of a song and dance that we have seen and heard before. I'm speaking with Chad Livengood, Lansing reporter for the Detroit News, and Chris Gouts, who's capital correspondent for Crain's Detroit Business, as we kind of dissect the nearly baked final budget for the next fiscal year for the state of Michigan. And guys, one of the biggest increases to come out of the education budget was for early childhood education. We've heard Governor Snyder talking about his desire to see this boosted. $65 million is a 60% bump over the current funding. And there was consensus on both sides of the aisle. How about that? Republicans and Democrats both voted for this money. Chad, how surprised were you by that?
Not too surprised. There's been a growing consensus that more needs to be done to get access for all kids at age 3 or 4 to early preschool, because you know a lot of preschool programs are paid, and so this actually will increase the income level up to $39,000 for a single parent with one child for them to get free preschool, or $59,000 for a family of four. So it's going to really kind of get into a little bit into the middle class before it was really for the really low poor families. And they're adding 16,000 kids to preschool next fall. If there is one victory the governor got out of this budget, this was it for sure.
Now let's talk about victories. That was one for him. He did not get the victory he wanted on transportation funding. And we have, all three of us, talked about this a lot before on Stateside. And as you guys mentioned, governor was looking for $1.2 billion just this year for fixing roads and bridges. He didn't get it. Instead, he got about $350 million. And that money's coming because of an unexpected revenue windfall. Chris, can you explain that to us?
Yeah, there was an issue. This is a federal issue, so that the state lawmakers can actually thank the federal government for something. When there was all this talk about the sequester, there was a lot of fear that there were going to be increased tax rates this year. So a lot of people made some changes to their personal holdings and into their stock portfolios. And so there was this influx of cash before the end of the year. And so that it really translated into, you know, around, was it $400 million or so. And so they were able to use that money for a lot of things to sort of patch up this budget. But it's still not in any way close to enough. Some people are calling it a down payment. It really isn't even that. It's kind of a drop in the bucket. Because it's, you know, a couple $100 million for transportation for this year. But that's only one-time money. The governor was looking for $1.2 billion per year in new revenue. And then so there's this money for priority roads. And then there's also this promise 6 months from now of transportation getting another $115 million. And I was talking with an administration official over the last week on the island who said that their concern is that while that's great, their fear is that that's going to be sort of given to them as a sort of a consolation prize if they don't come up with the hard votes to get this $1.2 billion annually.
So what does he do now with the road funding and his desire to get the roads fixed? I mean, it certainly fell way short of where he wanted.
Well, tomorrow, the House Transportation Committee has scheduled possible votes on some of the gas tax bills. So this could, I mean, they've already voted out like a change in fuel tax for aviation planes, but they're actually going to possibly take a vote tomorrow after about 4 months of debating this. They're going to take a vote tomorrow, possibly at a committee, on whether to start changing the gas tax. And this gets into this whole kind of complicated system here where they're going to have to get rid of our current cents per gallon net gas tax and go to a percentage-based tax that can grow over time. Because right now at 19 cents a gallon, you know, gas is $4.15 right now across the state. And when they put this 19 cents a gallon gas into place, gas was like $1.25 in 1997. So it has not been able to change. And so this is the big hurdle. With that, if you do this, you have to get rid of the sales tax on gasoline, which is another tax that doesn't even go to gasoline, as we've talked about. It doesn't even go to roads, as we've talked about before. To do that, then you leave this billion-dollar hole for schools and municipalities. So that's the next complicated part in this dance, is then this other proposal to go to the voters and ask for a 1 cent sales tax. That's a huge hurdle to cross, because they've got to get a two-thirds vote in the legislature just to get that on the ballot. Oof. So we are a long ways from seeing any light at the end of the tunnel on this one.
And as we talked about earlier in our conversation here, also not in the budget and considered a loss for the governor was money for Medicaid expansion. Democrats want it, and some Republicans said no, it was part of the federal Affordable Care Act. So give us more of the background on this debate, Chris.
Well, like you said, this is really an issue where lawmakers just do not want to vote for anything that has any connection to Obamacare. So the House Republicans have really taken this new path, and they're while they're expanding Medicaid, they don't call it that. They've created this new name for it. And when you ask them about expanding Medicaid, they say, "Oh, you mean Healthy Michigan?" That they don't want it. They do not want it to be described in any way as expanding Medicaid, even though that's exactly what they're doing. And so because they're doing that, they've instituted a very controversial piece to this, and that it would limit the amount of time an able-bodied adult could be on Medicaid to 48 months, which is kind of silly when you think about it, because the other piece of this plan is that it's a three-year program. So you're fighting over a four-year cap on a three-year program. So when I talked with the governor and some other folks about this last week on the island, and it just seems like that four-year cap is really a big sticking point for Republicans, because they don't want to go home and as having voted to expand Medicaid without being able to say, but we also made sure that people aren't going to be able to live off this system for the rest of their lives. You know, we're really trying to make it a hand up to people, not a handout, like, as you always often hear from Republicans, and say that we really put a cap on this program.
Chad, I want to ask you what your thoughts are about what these losses, if you will, say about Rick Snyder, as he seems to be unable to get Republicans to get on board with him or get the votes from Democrats.
Well, the governor has had a different climate since he signed Right to Work. He gave the far right of his party everything they wanted, pretty much. And now he is finding difficulty. He has a smaller majority in the House. And he doesn't have Democrats who are willing to come along and help him on some things. That would be Rhodes right there. And then on the other end, he's getting it from both sides. And the right wing that he really helped out there with Right to Work and a lot of other legislation in the last 2 years, they're not going along with Medicaid expansion.
Well, finally, guys, a budget really does show priorities and you know, what do we want to spend on and invest in, and what do we want to cut? So overall, I'd like the thoughts of each of you. What does this almost firmed up budget say about Michigan right now, Chris?
Well, I think it shows that financially, just for the state's books, that we are on sort of this better path, and we're not talking about cuts, whether it's mid-year or at the beginning of the budget cycle. And the governor is really starting to talk about targeted structural investments, especially as it relates to this early childhood program. That's the one thing that when I talked with the governor, he pulled out and said, this was a win for us. We really got this, because he sees the value in this. When he introduced his budget back earlier this year, he cited the study from this group in Ypsilanti called the High Scope Educational Research Foundation, which showed that what they're doing with these four-year-olds, it's actually increasing the number. I think it was 58% of students that were in that four-year program for four-year-olds, that they were graduating. 58% of them were graduating high school on time compared to those who weren't in the program. And so he's trying to make this point that we really have to get involved in education, but Democrats will always say, no matter what the numbers are, that this administration has not been investing in education. So you're always going to hear different stories, but I think that sort of shows where we're at now. We're definitely on a better footing financially. The rating agencies all agree, and so it is what it is, I suppose.
Chad, your thoughts?
Yeah, and on the politics of all this, I mean, even though the Democrats are quick to trash this bill on education, eight freshman Democrats from marginal districts voted for the education bill last week in the House. Because you don't want to be in a tough re-election and having the Republicans saying you voted against education. So going forward, I think Chris is right that there is good signs that the state's economy is recovering, and that there is a sustained growth in the budget, and that gives the state the ability to kind of catch up in some areas where they really lost out in the last decade.
Breaking down the budget for us was Chad Livengood, Lansing reporter for the Detroit News, and, of course, Chris Gouts, Capital correspondent for Crain's Detroit Business. Always good to talk to you guys. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.